docket for today. Thomas James Simon II versus Commonwealth. Ms. Dillon, nice to have you back with the court.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, please. 5 minutes.
All right. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Julia Dillon. I represent appellant Thomas Simon. I would like to note that this case really, if you find on the second assignment of error that the evidence was insufficient, then the first assignment of error is essentially moot. So I would like to start my argument by focusing on the second assignment of error.
The first assignment of error, what did you say?
It would be moot if you find that the second assignment of error is valid. If you find that the evidence is insufficient as to everything, then the issue with regards to the hearsay would essentially be a moot point. The strongest of those arguments is the one I would like to start with. That has to do with the assault on the school bus, of the people on the school bus. There were two counts of misdemeanor assault. I don't believe there was any evidence in the record that he even saw the school bus in this case. And I would submit that there isn't any evidence that or any authority to suggest that you can have an actual assault, an apprehension of fear, or some type of cause of the apprehension of fear if there isn't any evidence that you are intending any ill will or intending to cause that fear, or even that you know that you're doing it.
You can do it with a vehicle, right? If I ran my vehicle really close to you with the intention to either harm you or make you fearful that I might hit you with the vehicle, couldn't that be an assault?
If you were the one driving it and if you were the one actually trying to do it. So if you see me and you're trying to gun me down in a parking lot, yes, that could be an assault. And there were a couple of cases cited to that effect. The one was the Moody case, the other was the Haywood case, I believe, where those were actually in the malicious wounding portion of it. But if in those cases, Haywood was found that they were not actually trying to go after someone with malice when they were striking the objects and the other one was striking a pedestrian.
Yes. I'm not sure the error was, there's not enough proof I have to operate the car.
That is a large part of it, yes. For the assault, there were several different things that he was convicted of doing. The one is just the drunk driving, which is just operating the vehicle at all.
Assault battery.
Yes.
Not for Hollison, UWF.
Yes. The malicious wounding has to do with his wife, Ruth Sinan.
Uh-huh.
The assault and battery has, or not the battery, I'm sorry, it was just assault, has to do with the two people on the school bus.
Yeah.
For that one, whether, even if you don't find, or even if you do find that he had grabbed the steering wheel or was in some way operating the car, there's no, or the vehicle, there was no evidence that he even saw the school bus approaching. Ruth didn't see the school bus approaching. No one in the bus said that he was making eye contact or trying to go after them. They couldn't tell what was going on. So that's an extremely circumstantial case, and there's no evidence that he was trying to hurt anyone on the school buses.
You're saying there's no mens rea?
There's no mens rea, and there's no actus rea, so there's really no crime there at all. So that's why I believe that's the strongest of the three. Beyond that, then we go to whether he was... I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor?
Oh, I'm just thinking, I'm sorry.
Oh. All right. Beyond that, when you then move to the case with regards to Ruth Sinan, there are two different issues. And the one is whether or not he had malice to actually try and harm her, and the other one is whether or not he was even in control of the vehicle. If you include those hearsay statements, then there is some evidence that he had some control over the vehicle, and there was...
He was grabbing the wheel while she was driving. Isn't that the, what we have statements to the police at the scene of? She says, as well as there's some other statement, I think, from him.
That was the statement that she had made to the person who went into the vehicle.
Right.
And
who,
that was...
Who'd been on the school bus.
He had been on the school bus, and he went in to see if she was okay. It was a little confusing in the record as to just when she made those statements. I don't know whether that was before or after she asked him to get the money out of the glove compartment and hand to her so that she couldn't want to give the money to the husband that she was mad at who was sitting outside. So I don't know whether she had already been in that state of deliberation or not. It really wasn't very clear. However, it was clear that she was mad. There was the one car accident. She was the driver of the automobile. There's no question about that. She could have been charged with reckless driving, and the statement was a blame-shifting statement as opposed to a statement against penal interest, but I'm getting off track a little.
Say that, you know, he was saying to her, you know, I didn't mean to do it. Maybe I'm sorry. All these apologies. If she's trying to shift blame to him, why is he saying all of that?
Well, I would submit that I don't think he said I didn't mean to do it. He did say I didn't mean to hurt you or hurt us or anything like that.
I didn't want to hurt you.
I didn't want
Maybe
to hurt you.
I didn't mean this. I wasn't trying to hurt us.
And I would submit, even based on her testimony, that just the arguing and the issues that they were having in the vehicle before, she was getting mad and getting distracted and looking for the money, according to her testimony, that just the distracting her is something that he could be apologizing for. And I would also submit that the act of apologizing immediately after undermined the claim of malice. I haven't seen any other case where malicious wounding is sustained where someone is acting in an apologetic manner as soon as something occurs, or where they're putting themselves in equal harm as they're putting their assailant. Malicious wounding is going after someone with a knife, going after someone with a car, not putting themselves at risk of harm along with the other person and immediately apologizing for it. So I would submit that that does not show any type of malice.
Why was Ruth's statement not an excited utterance, except for the hearsay rule under Rule 2, 8032?
Under Doe, there are several factors that need to be considered, and the self-serving nature of the statement was never considered by the trial court. This was a very self-serving statement, because it was a one-car accident where she was the driver. So under any other circumstances, she would have been the one in trouble.
Do you have any law that says an excited utterance cannot be a self-serving statement?
I would point to Doe in stating that that is one of the factors to consider with regards to reliability. The general presumption against keeping hearsay statements out because they're considered unreliable unless there's that indicia of reliability, as well as the fact that the code does recognize that self-serving statements or statements against penal interests are considered more reliable. I believe that was 2804, I believe is the standard hearsay rule. And so that whole area of case law supports the theory that it is not reliable if it is shifting the blame onto someone else. It's only reliable if it's a statement against penal interests. And this was clearly the opposite.
One of the things that's always been the focus of an excited utterance is the timing of the utterance. In other words, if an individual has a time for reflection or has a time to answer questions or something like that, those are the type of utterances that the courts have viewed as not an excited utterance except for to the hearsay rule. But in this case, isn't it true that the statement was made without any questioning by the person who heard the statement, and that it bore a pretty good time relation to the time of the excited event?
I would submit that while it is close in time, that it is not clear whether there was time for reflection or not. And the reason for that, part of what confuses me the most in it, is that somewhere in there she was able to direct the person who was in the car next to her to go into the glove compartment and get the money out and stick that in her bra as well because she didn't want the husband to have it. And I don't know whether the statements at issue were before or after that point. I was not very clear on that. He indicated that she would come in and out, go from excited to calming down. He did ask the general question of, are you okay, you know, things like that. So he had made some inquiries. I would also submit...
But those were not the type of questions that would elicit the response that she provided. Are you okay? Usually you get a yes or no, or I don't know, or something like that. Not this sort of rambling, culpable thing that she provided to the person who heard the statement.
Yes, however, being close in time or being spontaneous is not the only factor to consider. And part of the reason for that is any mother or parent knows if your kid does something wrong and you come in right away, their first instinct is not, oh yeah, I did that. Or if two kids are together and something breaks, they're not automatically going to say, oh yes, that was my fault. Their initial reaction is to blame someone else, and that's a matter of self-preservation. And so in this case, there is not that indicia of reliability just because it was close in time. If anything, I would state being that close in time and in such a extreme circumstance would have a reason for her to try to preserve herself and blame the person that she was mad at. And so I would submit that makes it less reliable.
That little framework is antithetical to the case law that provides, because the case law seems to focus on the fact that if it's more contemporaneous with the event, that it makes for more reliability.
The case law focuses on having multiple factors to be able to consider looking for that indicia of reliability. And so it's looking at all of the circumstances to determine whether or not that statement is reliable. And oftentimes being close in time or being spontaneous would be determinative. I think probably in 95 times out of 100 it would be. But if you get those cases where it is clearly being stated for self-preservation, then I would submit that that is not reliable. And that is consistent with the case law in Doe, and it's consistent with the other hearsay exceptions and
here,
the basic rationale for the statement.
Here, but if someone is badly injured, and she was injured a fair amount, isn't the excited utterance, the whole point of it is that it's in a moment of stress and anxiety, and so therefore the truth is more likely to come out. That's the reason for the exception to the hearsay rule. So I understand your argument is you've got people doing things they shouldn't, they'll immediately say, no, it wasn't me, it was him. But that, as Judge Alston says, flies in the face of what our case law on excited utterance is.
The case law is not limited to just that one factor, though. And I believe that under Doe, you need to look at all of the factors and all of the circumstances and whether in this particular case that hearsay statement shows the indicia of reliability necessary to rely upon it. And given the fact that it's completely inconsistent with her sworn testimony at trial and that it's not consistent with the physical evidence that was shown in the case, even though there's very little physical evidence, I believe it does not have that reliability.
Okay.
Is that my time for rebuttal?
Yes, it does.
All right, thank you.
You're getting to your rebuttal time, so I'm sure you probably want your rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am. Thank
you. Have that. Ms. Tyson.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'd like to talk about the excited utterance exception first and then move on to the sufficiency. It's very important, I think, first of all, to remember that the trial court rejected the trial testimony. It may have been sworn testimony, but the court rejected it as incredible, page 307 of the appendix. The excited utterance exception is not the same exception as the exception against penal interest or an admission by a party. In fact, the excited utterance exception, which is at 2:8032, is one which is spontaneous or impulsive, prompted by a startling event or condition and made by a declarant with firsthand knowledge at a time and under circumstances negating deliberation. The case law has referred to it as prompted by a startling event or condition, has referred to it as under the agitation of a startling event. And that's what we have here. It's the startling event. In fact, some cases have even discussed excited utterance as saying it's the event speaking through the person rather than the person narrating the event. And the trustworthiness is in the spontaneity, which is why the close in time is very, very important. And here it was very close in time. Mr. Jackson, who had been riding on the bus, is the one who got into the van and asked her, are you okay? What happened? And she provided the rambling, in his words, rambling response of what had happened. And so she is injured. He describes her as hysterical, and he used a strange word. He said a bit shocky, hurt, hysterical, shaky, and a bit shocky, meaning in shock. And so she responds and says to Mr. Jackson that she and the defendant were having an argument, that he struck her, he grabbed the wheel, she fought to get it back, that he tried to kill them. Actually, that, I think, was what she said to the other woman. But to Mr. Jackson, she provided, this is what happened. And this is her, she's still in the car. She hasn't even been able to get out of the car, in the van, and when she's talking to Mr. Jackson. So this is the event speaking through her. It is the quintessential excited utterance.
It's like the first cousin to the dying declaration.
It almost is. And of course, the reason for dying declaration is that, and it would be great if this were still true, but I think it doesn't have as much support as it used to, that aren't going to die with a lie on your lips. That's giving you the trustworthiness. The trustworthiness. But you know, you don't want to enter whatever's coming next with a lie on your lips. And this
one colleague made a very good point. You said something really interesting in response. She said, well, there were other things that she was talking about, too, which would undermine the fact that it was an excited utterance. But if you look at it in the context of a dying declaration, oftentimes people who are dying will acknowledge that they're dying, state the circumstances which caused them to be that way, and say, make sure you know that the will is in the strong box.
Right.
In other words, talking about things that are sort of outside what has caused them to have this declaration or this utterance, but making reference to something else doesn't necessarily undermine the declaration or the utterance that was made, as long as the proper context was made.
And in this case, this is the startling event that is speaking. And I want to talk about Doe versus Thomas, because not that this matters at all, but it certainly surprised me that there was any discussion of self-serving. It seems to me that if self-serving were part of excited utterance, it would be here, and it's not. So looking at Doe versus Thomas, what I have concluded is that the discussion of self-serving really goes to whether there was deliberation. That if you've got a self-serving statement, is it really spontaneous, or have you had time to think about it?
I think the self-serving component actually goes to the weight that you might want to give the excited utterance.
Well, and in Doe, the facts in that case, 18 hours after, and it is a civil case, it's Doe versus Thomas, 18 hours after the accident, and the declarant has been in and out of consciousness, and his sister comes and asks them a question with regard to what happened, and he is placing the blame for whatever has happened, this accident, on the other person. And the court went through and looked at all the factors, although the time was not determinative, the question was not determinative. In looking at all the factors, the court did speak of self-serving. He was getting himself out of trouble. The Doe versus Thomas is so, so different from the case that we have before the court today, because the statements here happened within moments of the accident. And I know that Mr. Jackson was on the scene in less than a minute, but I don't believe he spoke to Mrs. Sinan in the van until a couple minutes after the accident had happened. In Clark, we've got a 5 to 10 minute range. In Hicks, the court talked about, I believe in that case, the defendant had argued, well, you shouldn't be able to say anything under the excited utterance exception beyond "I was shot." And the court said no, that was not correct. So this is not a mere narrative of a completed affair, but it is part of the instinctive reaction to a horrifying event. That's Clark. So that's why the excited utterance that we have in this case from Mrs. Sinan is evidence that was properly admitted. With regard to self-serving, I point the court to page 252 of the appendix, where Mrs. Sinan, at least at the time, did not believe she could be charged for the accident. So whether it might at some point, this may have been of some help to her, at least at that point in time, she did testify she'd been in an accident before and had not been charged, so she was not thinking about who was being charged. She was thinking about what was going on, which was she thought that her husband was trying to kill them both. And she's in an accident having crashed into an embankment, and the car rolled down, and she's stuck in the van, and the defendant has gotten out of the van. So for all these reasons, the excited utterance was properly admitted. The trial court, as the fact finder, rejected the trial testimony when the wife came in and testified that what she said was incorrect at the time of the accident.
And if that excited utterance comes in, then there isn't much question but that the defendant was operating the vehicle.
Correct. And I think Duggar is the case that was discussed in the briefs with regard to taking the wheel. And the trial court said, in finding guilt, that he may not have permanently been in control of that vehicle, but at least momentarily he was in control and was the cause of what had happened. And what happened, getting us into the issue of whether there was malice for malicious wounding, whether there was an intent that can be imputed for the assault, is the result of what happened was that he drove into the oncoming traffic with a sharp and abrupt turn. Now, nobody on the bus could see who was driving, and none of the testimony satisfied that. So we have the excited utterance of Ms. Sinan, and then we have him apologizing after the accident is over to a number of people who heard that. And so if we look at the malicious wounding,
can you go back to
yes.
the assault of the chaperone?
Absolutely.
Explain why, what in the record shows that that was something.
I think that Parrish is the case that that was cited on brief that I think is perhaps most helpful, because Parrish, in talking about intent, discusses two things that I think are important. One is the natural and probable consequences of what you do. When we look at it in intent, we don't have anyone, we certainly don't have the defendant here saying, this is what I intended to do. We know he was angry. We have testimony to that in that regard. But we end up looking at the conduct viewed under the circumstances and whether there can be the imputed intent under those circumstances, because that's what we've got. We've got someone who takes a car, a van, which is a weapon in and of itself, and then we've got a sharp turn into oncoming traffic and testimony from people on bus number two, Ms. Hiddleston, the bus driver, and then Ms. Knapper, who was on that bus, that the car came, or the van came within, one witness said within inches, the other said less than a car length. And so the intent has to be gleaned in this case from the circumstantial evidence, from the actions that were taken, and the reality of the situation.
Whatever vehicle was there, whatever occupants of that vehicle, be it a school bus or another car, would have been assaulted and by appellant because he was grabbing the car wheel and turning the vehicle.
Yes, and in fact, one of the witnesses said that the car was coming straight at them. Here we go. It's Ms. Knapper on 87, that the van turned abruptly. It was headed straight towards us. And, of course, there was no collision with the bus, but there was that apparent ability to have the collision, and it was coming pretty fast, was page 88 was her testimony. And then 90, 127 to 128, 203, we've got the apology of the defendant after he gets out of the top of the van is dealing with the aftermath of the accident and seeking to get away from that accident. Moody was a case that was discussed by counsel. In that case, that was the teacher who tried to stop the person who was driving. And so the intent must be gleaned from the circumstances, from everything that's in the evidence. It is a circumstantial case as far as intent goes. But that intent can be imputed. And it flows from the fact that we've got the malicious intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill the person who's in the car with him, which brings us to the malicious wounding. He has taken over the control of that car. There is, according to the testimony, the excited utterance that was accepted, they were in a dispute. The defendant had struck Ms. Sinan, then grabbed the wheel. She fought to get it back. And the malice and the intent can, again, must be gleaned from the circumstances. Ms. Sinan did say at the scene he was trying to kill us. I believe that's on page 160. He tried to kill us both.
Do you say to Ms. Dillon's argument that it's natural for someone who is at the wheel to, after, oh my gosh, I've been in this horrible accident, to put the blame on someone else so that they're not held responsible when the police get there shortly?
Right. And my response to that, I think, would be, again, on the testimony from page, I think it's on 252 of the appendix, where she had been in an accident one other time and had not been held responsible for it. I think that really goes to, was there deliberation? And there wasn't a chance for her to deliberate in this case. Mr. Jackson, the person from the bus, you know, heard something coming from the van very promptly, went and investigated. This happened very quickly. And if, indeed, an excited utterance is one where the event is speaking through the person, then I think that is perhaps the best response to, she was merely trying to get herself out of trouble by blaming the defendant. I think that the evidence is sufficient for each one of these offenses. The DUI, there was a stipulation that the blood alcohol was greater than 0.08, and that given the circumstantial evidence as it played out in this case, in the extremely dangerous situation, and the imputation, if that's even the right word, the imputing of the intent with regard to the assault, the clear establishment of the malice with regard to Mrs. Sinan, that each one of the convictions, each one of these offenses should be affirmed by this court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tyson. Ms. Dillon, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
I would like to start by noting that the trial court also rejected the theory that Mr. Sinan actually grabbed the wheel and turned it to the left into oncoming traffic. The trial court noted that there was no evidence of that at all, that at worst case scenario, he had grabbed the wheel and that caused her to overcompensate. Even with the excited utterance statements, it's not clear as to when she was saying he grabbed the wheel, because the testimony was that the car was weaving down the road before they even got close to the bus. They had noticed it a while before. So whether they're saying that they were fighting over it and then she lost control after the fact, but there is still no evidence at all that he actually saw the school bus and that he was aiming for it and trying to gun them down. There's just nothing like that in the record. There is also nothing that goes to the level of malice, even with those statements when you add in the apologies after the fact. He did not drive to the left. In the Parrish case, that was a case where there was clearly ill will. Every case that has to do with assault has to do with some type of ill will towards the people that they are assaulting. And that is just not there for the school bus in this case.
Why did he grab the wheel?
Well, he maintains that he didn't. He maintains that he didn't at all. If you were to believe the hearsay statements, then there would have been some type of disagreement between the two of them, or she had testified that she had felt some kind of a bump, and then that's when sort of reaching for the wheel, so whether it's to try and correct some type of a driving error or something like that. But that does not rise to the level of trying to hurt people in an oncoming car. And it does not go to the level of malice. If you were to believe everything, even if, I guess the least I would ask for is at least reversing the malicious wounding, if you were to find the unlawful wounding, if you were to find that the hearsay statement still came in as well. But my argument is that even with those statements, I don't believe that there is enough to show that he was trying to hurt his wife, that he had the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, or that he was trying to harm either one of them in the course of events.
Am I to understand you're asking this court to reduce this to unlawful wounding and remand for sentencing? Are you asking that?
Ideally, I would ask the court to reverse everything. If the court is not going to reverse everything, if the court is not inclined to reverse everything and does believe that there was a substantial evidence or that in construing the facts most favorably, there was evidence that he did in fact grab the wheel, I believe it, but there was not enough for malice, then I believe it would be appropriate to reduce to unlawful wounding. If this court were to find that there is insufficient evidence of intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, then it would be appropriate to reduce the charge down to assault and battery. And so I believe that the court does have many options in terms of how to decide this case and evaluating the evidence before it.
If we were to do that, just to follow up on Judge Haley's question, are you saying that it should just be remanded for resentencing on a lesser-included offense, or that it would need to go back for a new trial?
It depends on how it's done, Your Honor. If you were to find it just on the second assignment of error, that based on that the evidence was insufficient for the malicious wounding or the unlawful wounding, then yes, I believe it would be remanded back for sentencing. If the court were to find that the hearsay...
On that, based on the Supreme Court's decision a few years ago, I believe, right?
I would have to take your word for that one, Your Honor. If the court were to find based on the hearsay statement that the hearsay was an issue, then I believe it would have to be a new trial because that would be a difference of the evidence. I see I'm about out of time. Thank you very much for your time. I would ask the court to grant the petition or grant the brief in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Dillon. We will greet counsel, and then this court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.